Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, and that means a little bit later on, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and we're going to kick off the Monday morning movie reviews in just a couple of seconds here. Also, this weekend marked the 30th anniversary of Tim Burton's Batman, if you want to feel old. We'll talk a little bit about that. And also, we're going to talk about some of the best mafia and crime films of all time. And anytime you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, I was sick last week, so we didn't do the movie reviews. So we're going to catch up a little bit and just briefly touch upon the stuff that came out last week. And we have some lots of new stuff to talk about this week. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me each week to review the new movies. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. We can play a little catch-up from last week. Eric, why don't you tell us about Late Night?
Oh, okay. Late Night, this is one of the big sort of success stories at Sundance this year. Amazon, it was also the first big deal of the festival. It's a movie that stars Emma Thompson as, I think, the only female late night talk show host. And her ratings are not particularly strong. There is talk at the network of replacing her with a younger white male. But along comes comedy writer, or amateur comedy writer, Mindy Kaling, who basically finds herself the opportunity to get a job in the writer's room, becomes the only female writer in there, since Emma Thompson's character wants to hire and make a diversity hire and get a woman's voice in there. And slowly but surely, she starts to sort of adopt a stronger base. So her ratings begin to climb a little bit, and sort of these two parallel stories sort of interweaving in and out is what it's like to be a female voice in this particular time slot. But the thing about this movie is that it unfortunately is a movie that just has absolutely no bite to it whatsoever, despite being an R-rated film, and Mindy Kaling, who is certainly a very strong comedy voice. It doesn't have anything interesting or edgy to say about this particular period of time that we live in. This seems like a movie that could have been made 30 years ago, and even then would feel like an afterthought, you know, compared to other movies that occasionally have tackled this type of subject matter. So this is a real, I mean, it's not a real, particularly a bad film. It's just kind of, you know, it occasionally, you know, has, you know, a laugh here and there. I think Emma Thompson is quite good in the movie. I also like John Lithgow, who plays her husband in the film. I think a big problem with the movie is the Mindy Kaling character. It seems like just kind of shoved in from another movie. It's a little broader compared to the struggles that Emma Thompson's character is going through. And it just unfortunately, it never really comes together. It feels really a bit more sitcom-y than I think that they were really going for, and it's really unfortunate because everyone was ready for it, and some people bought into it. Clearly Amazon did, but I didn't.
Okay. Steve, where do you stand?
Yeah, about the same. It does feel like a very safe approach to this material, even though it is, I think it's R-rated, right, Eric? There's a lot of bad language in it, so yeah, I assume it is. But it still feels like something that would have dropped on Netflix pretty easily. I don't know. I actually thought that whenever they sort of stuck to the writing, the writer's room stuff and the behind-the-scenes stuff, it worked. It's when they keep getting sidetracked by, I mean, you said you like John Lithgow, Eric, but I didn't like that character even being in the movie that much. And there's a whole thing about him being sick, and there's a whole thing about her having an affair like a while back and getting, like, something finally comes out about it. And it just sort of distracts us from the more interesting stuff here. I didn't mind Mindy Kaling at all. In fact, the fact that she wrote this kind of makes it hard for me to believe that that Dever made me feel like she was like wedged in there somehow. But that'd be quite a feat if she somehow wedged her own character in there. But I was more interested in people like Amy Ryan, who plays this network executive who really seems to have it out for Catherine. But ultimately, they play it safe, and ultimately it's more like she just wants to be her friend and she's mad at her for not being friends with her or something. I mean, when they stay focused, it works, but otherwise, yeah, it's kind of a weak attempt at something that could have been, especially in this day and age, could have been really biting.
Yeah. Okay, I was ill, so I didn't get the chance to see it. All right, Steve, tell us about The Dead Don't Die.
This is the latest from Jim Jarmusch, a guy who has in the past definitely tackled in his own unique way genre films. In particular, he did one a few years ago about vampires that I particularly loved, called Only Lovers Left Alive. And if anyone has been watching or had been watching What We Do in the Shadows, we know there's been an update to that storyline, but quite brilliantly. But unfortunately, this film is not brilliant. This is a film about zombies, and he's nothing if not, Jarmusch is nothing if not versatile, but it seems really weird and, again, kind of lame the way he tackles this subject. And I feel like if he wanted to make the anti-zombie movie, that would have been fine with me, but some of the jokes are kind of, most of the jokes are kind of weak, and even the performance, he's got like an all-star cast of people that many of whom he's used before, including people like Adam Driver and Bill Murray. But man, does this it's such a slow burn, it might as well be a gas leak. Like, it's so bad. And it's really unfortunate. And like, the jokes just lay flat. He doesn't really have anything to add to the zombie lore. And it just seems like such a home run. Like, he's got Steve Buscemi and Larry Fessenden and Chloe Sevigny and RZA and like all these great people that I would watch in any movie, and to just have them collected here like this and do virtually nothing. And this is story of this small town where the zombies infiltrate, and everyone's kind of casual about it. And there's some sort of funny jokes that make it very self-referential, and they actually talk about the screenplay that they're acting out for us, and they talk about Jarmusch, you know, like he's around. And I guess that's clever, but man, it just feels like a bunch of hipsters getting together and make a zombie movie. So I was just disappointed as hell in this movie.
Okay. All right, Eric, what'd you think?
I wasn't disappointed. I was angry. this movie is a one joke movie, and the joke is on the audience because, like, it's basically expanding on what Steve said. It's, you know, it feels like, you know, Jarmusch has a lot of really famous friends that have worked with him and probably worked with him for nothing, like Bill Murray has a few times, and it's just like, okay, let's get together and make a zombie movie, you know, but we got nothing to say about the zombie movie. We got nothing to say about the world. You know, just wasting talent, just bleeding, wasting talent on screen, and we're expected to sit there and, you know, for the poor people have to actually pay to watch a film like this. It was frustrating at first, but then, you know, to realize that the only joke that they had was basically the idea that, you know, at least one character had read the entire screenplay, and when we get to like that being the ultimate joke in the movie, it's just like really, that's, oh, we waited an hour and 20 minutes for you, you know, to spring this on the audience, and this is all we have. I mean, it's not horrific, it's not funny, it's just, they don't have to play with any of the conventions. I don't know why this movie exists, other than Jarmusch just got his friends together and was like, hey, let's make a movie. And granted, I'm not Jarmusch hipster going way back, though. You know, I very much like Patterson. I liked his last film very much. And I think that's, if you want to see Jarmusch work with Adam Driver really well, you go back and watch that movie, and you throw this one on the fire at the end of Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, well, I liked it. I liked it. I thought it was really funny.
And
I'm a big Jarmusch fan anyway, but I thought it was really funny, and I thought the zombie stuff was great. The cast, I think, is having a really good time here. I laughed my ass off at Adam Driver. Every time he opened his mouth, I thought it was funny. Chloe Sevigny is really charming and funny in this. Tom Waits, is Tom Waits. I thought there was some really very funny zombie stuff in this, and Tilda Swinton rules the planet. And I loved her in this movie, and I really thought that her big final scene at the end was ridiculous, and I thought that was handled really well. But yeah, I liked it. I know I'm in the minority on this one, but I really did like it. So there you go. All right, Eric, Steve, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. We'll take a quick break. We're going to catch up a little bit on a couple of the other movies that opened last week, considering I was off, and so we're going to review a couple more, and then we'll get to the new movies as we proceed here on 720 WGN. We got a break here for the news, though.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood, player.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about the best mafia mob movies of all time. And Tim Burton's Batman celebrated its 30th anniversary. If you want to feel really old, we'll talk about that too. But right now, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me, as they do every week, to review all the new movies. We're catching up because I was off last Monday morning, so we're catching up on a couple of things that opened last week, and then we'll go to the new ones as well. Here's Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Let's see. Eric, tell us about Men in Black International.
Oh, do I have to? Basically a reboot of the Men in Black series. We no longer have Tommy Jones and Will Smith to kick around anymore. But now we have Tessa Thompson, who play at the as part of the movie is a young girl who discovers the Men in Black. They neuralize her parents, but don't neuralize her, and she spends a good portion of her life trying to track down who these people are, what this agency is, and basically finds her way to the headquarters. And as the headquarters show a remarkable nonsense of security in basically letting her in, and she impresses the head of the agency, played by Emma Thompson, to give her a shot at being a woman in black. She doesn't have a lot of skills other than apparently reading maps of the actual stars, and stumbles into a case with Chris Hemsworth, who is sort of the young hotshot Men in Black, under the tutelage of Liam Neeson, who is the section chief in London, and they go off on a mission to stop the latest threat to Earth that involves a hive mind and a couple of aliens that come down. I think it's the same aliens that come down from in Dark Phoenix, basically, who are trying to take over the planet Earth.
Yeah.
Okay. If there was a movie that could possibly make me angrier than The Dead Don't Die, it was this one. This movie, I couldn't, even watching it, couldn't understand why it existed. Like, what was their motivation for putting this thing together? Obviously, there have been articles now written about the production problems with this movie, but that's not an excuse, because what's on the screen is completely inexcusable. I can't believe the people who even wrote the movie had even seen the previous movies. Twice in the first 10 minutes of the movie, the Men in Black's MO apparently is now to explain all the secrets of the universe to people and then neuralize them, as opposed to them just kind of accidentally stumbling upon stuff and erasing their memories after that. The hiring practices of the Men in Black is incredibly lapsed. I don't understand how Tessa Thompson's character could even get a gig. And it's a reminder of one of the really funny segments of the original Men in Black, which was the training sequence and the testing sequence that Will Smith has to go through. You get none of that here. She's just immediately given the glasses and the suit and is put in, you know, to find her own case. She just kind of wanders around the building until she comes upon something. There's no clever jokes here. The villains are lame. The aliens are lame. Just when you think the thing is over, it goes on for another 20 minutes after a twist that pretty much anyone can see coming. Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth have zero chemistry in the film whatsoever. I was not the biggest Ragnarok fan in the world, but at least there they showed a semblance of something. Here there's absolutely nothing. Everyone is not even... You'd have to crank it up 10 notches to get on autopilot. This movie is just an absolute zero from start to finish.
All right, Steve?
These just keep getting worse. They just keep one just is worse than the last one.
Yeah.
And I will say I disagree with Eric on just one thing. The one saving grace of this film for me, and it's a pretty big one, is that Hemsworth and Thompson do have a tremendous natural chemistry. And I was genuinely looking forward, especially after Ragnarok and Avengers Endgame, of seeing them together again and just giving me something that reminded me of the spark from those films. And it's there for me. Literally the entire movie is built around now how these two are meant to work together and complement each other. And it still doesn't help. Like, it still doesn't fix the problems of this movie. Sadly, their chemistry isn't enough, and I doubt anything other than like a page one rewrite would have really been enough to keep me from scratching my eyes out while I'm watching this thing. But it just is weird to watch how this film reduced itself to just repeating all the old tropes and the jokes and the situations from previous films. And at a certain point, here's how bad this movie is and how forgettable it is. When I was just writing the review of it, I noticed that Rebecca Ferguson's name was in there. I'm like, oh, yeah, she was in this. I completely forgot. Yeah. She has like a whole scene that she's in. And I totally, it doesn't have anything to do with anything, really. And I completely forgot she was in it as soon as it was over. And I love her. I think she's great. And she just, it's like my memory was erased after this film. So, I hope this is the fourth installment. Maybe that's wishful thinking. I hope this is the final installment. I mean, I hope that's not just wishful thinking. I think they're done.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is a terrible movie. And I agree with you, Steve. Men in Black movie has gotten worse, progressively worse. And this is by far the worst, the worst of the, how many are four of them now?
And again,
I agree with you, Steve. I like the two leads a lot. I loved Ragnarok, and I thought they were great together in that. So there's something there, but there's nothing on the page. There's just nothing. This is a movie that just shouldn't. You were talking about how certain movies shouldn't exist. There's no reason that this movie. No, absolutely no reason why this movie was made. And I could tell that just from the trailer. You know, when I first saw the trailer, I'm like, what are you kidding me? What? Why do we need this movie? And evidently, it's not making any money at the box office. So, I think the people have spoken. But yeah, no, this is a terrible, terrible movie. So, really quickly, because I want to get to the new stuff. Mm-hmm. But I know that you guys both like The Last Black Man in San Francisco, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good one that came out last week.
It's a great one.
Yeah.
One of the best of the year, actually. Yeah.
And it's
is
it playing in a bunch of theaters or?
I think it's at the Landmark. I don't know where else besides that it might be.
Yeah, I don't think it expanded at all this week. It's still kind of trying to find its audience. So I think it might be in two or three theaters around the city.
Let me check here. It's at the River East down here.
Okay.
It's playing at the River East and the Landmark and in Evanston. So just those three theaters.
And, so you got no excuse.
And so you guys are all over. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Terrific film.
Okay. All right. I wanted to make sure we mentioned at least a good one from last week.
Yeah.
So, I've seen it twice, so yeah, I can definitely recommend it.
Okay, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, that's the one that came out last week that everybody liked. There was a Shaft, another Shaft movie that came out last week. Steve, you want to tell us briefly about that?
If you really want to get to the new stuff, we could just skip it, because it's terrible. It's really, here's the thing, it's not, the action isn't good, and apparently the Shaft movies are comedies now, because that's all Tim Story really knows how to direct. So,
well, he doesn't really know how to direct that either.
I'll give him the first Barbershop anyway. So, but I mean, seriously, it's weird. It's actually jarring how many jokes are told here that just, whether they're good or not, it's just weird that they've completely changed the vibe of it. It's you know, it used to be, I mean, I realize Shaft is maybe culturally inappropriate now, but at least his attitudes are, but man, they don't even try to have fun with that. So,
okay.
I don't know. I don't have much more to say about it, because it's really not good.
Eric, you thought it was bad as well?
Oh, it's terrible. And to follow up on what Steve was just saying there, is that the movie, you know, I think that's what it was trying to do, is to sort of make the comic stance that Shaft is an inappropriate father figure for young Black America nowadays, but again, it can't even bring itself to be that, because half the time it's actually arguing that Shaft's way is the right way, by the end of the movie, you know, his abandoned son is, you know, shooting guns and, you know, talking and dressing and acting like his, you know, his estranged father. And I gotta say, I mean, one of the biggest problems I have with this movie, Jesse Usher's performance as the son is one of the worst performances of the year. I'm not familiar with this guy's work. I don't know where he's from, but just everything he does in this movie is so grating, and it was so uncomfortable to watch his performance in this movie. And it's just bad.
Yeah. And again, are they just titling movies over and over again, the same title over and over again? I mean,
it's like George Foreman's kids.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous.
But the more uncomfortable thing, Nick, too, is that if you remember the Singleton movie, which I actually defend, I actually liked the John Singleton.
I did too.
Which was at the time a remake.
Yeah.
But Richard Roundtree makes a cameo in that movie as Uncle John Shaft.
Right.
In this movie, they actually go back and they say, well, he said he was my uncle for all these years, so it's actually Shaft.
Yeah.
So there are actually three movies now named Shaft, and they're all in the same universe.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. Okay, guys, hang on a second, okay?
Yep.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we got all the new movies to talk about for this weekend, and that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's jokey time. And we're going to talk about mafia and mob movies and all kinds of fun stuff. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Right now, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress are joining me, and we're going to jump into the new movies that came out this week and review all of those. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Steve, tell us about Echo in the Canyon.
Echo in the Canyon is a music documentary that celebrates the California music scene and the birth of the California sound specifically in the years 1965 to 1967. And it came out of Laurel Canyon, which is an area in L.A., and it was sort of a combination of some of the bands at the time trying to sound a little bit like the Beatles, but also they wanted to do some more electric versions of folk music that was popular at the time, and so you got bands like the Byrds and the Beach Boys and Buffalo Springfield and the Mamas and the Papas and a whole bunch of other ones. And so the movie is actually like three movies. One is more sort of just a history lesson from director Andrew Slater, who began his career as a music journalist and then a record producer and then a record executive at Capitol Records. And then, so that's the sort of one part. And then there's also a recording, a multiple recording sessions of a sort of a tribute album to the sound that's spearheaded by the executive producer of the film, Jacob Dylan, who also conducts a lot of interviews with some of the surviving people from that scene, and which actually I think he really adds something, not so much by narration or anything like that, but I think these musicians like talking to another musician about this. I think that they get a lot more detailed stories about the scene, about the music. Some of it's a little bit on the CD side, which is great. We love that. But I think they just feel more comfortable around Jacob Dylan, even though he doesn't really talk that much on camera. And then there's a third movie that's a concert film, again, with Jacob Dylan sort of spearheading things, and he has a bunch of guest musicians playing with him, mostly newer musicians like Beck and Fiona Apple and Cat Power and Regina Spektor and Norah Jones. And they play sort of a concert film, again, playing a lot of the same covers of these same songs. The whole thing is really a great immersion into this music, and I just thoroughly enjoy any music documentary that teaches me a little something. I mean, you know most of these songs, but you probably don't know that much about the era they came out of, and just sort of who and why and who they sort of were trying to copy and or who their influences were. If anything, I almost wish it covered a little bit more time so we could get into some other people like Joni Mitchell and stuff like that. But still, this is like that initial era that essentially evaporated for a little while because egos got in the way, shockingly enough, in the music world. Egos are a part of it. But yeah, it's a terrific little film. And we just did a screening of it at the Music Box this past Friday. And Jacob Dylan was there with the director, and they played like a 6 or 7 song show. And I should mention this film, one of the people who was most influenced by this sound is Tom Petty, who is featured in the film in his last on-camera interview, and he has a lot to say about this scene, a lot about that, even specifically about instruments that they played that sort of gave it that sound. And if for no other reason, that's a great reason to see the film. So, okay. So definitely check that out.
All right, it's at the Music Box and at the ArcLight. If people are interested, it's Echo in the Canyon. There you go. All right, Eric. Evidently, Luc Besson has not retired, as he said.
Still making movies.
Yeah. Tell us about Anna.
Okay. This is the newest film from Luc Besson, although stop me if you have heard this plot description before. a junkie who ends up in a sort of the wrong end of a criminal plot gone wrong, and everyone around her is killed, is recruited by a secret government agency that turns her into an assassin for hire. That's not exactly how the film begins. This is a movie obsessed with flashbacks and flash forwards to bring you up to speed on information that, what just when you want the movie to go forward, it goes backwards. Sasha Luss plays Anna. Luke Evans plays the Uncle Bob, so to speak, of the agency who recruits her. Helen Mirren plays the sort of the head of this organization and part of the training process. Cillian Murphy plays a CIA or FBI operative. American operative, who is actually very interested in all the dead bodies that seem to be occurring whenever this Anna character is around. So basically what you have here is La Femme Atomic Red Blonde Dumb Sparrow. it's kind of remarkable that and how shameless Luc Besson is at, you know, not just taking from his own work, but from all these other movies that just seemingly have just come out recently. And he really, I mean, there's nothing, again, this is a movie that adds absolutely nothing to that thing except these series of flashbacks that just when you think that some crazy twist has happened or someone has been killed or, you know, double crossed in a certain way, the title card comes on that says 3 months earlier or 3 years earlier or 5 years earlier, and show you exactly how Anna or someone in the agency or one of these other characters set something up so it's not exactly what you're seeing in the future, which is now actually the past of something that we've already seen and was foreshadowed. And on top of it, it's a 2-hour movie that more or less, aside from the sort of random assassination scenes, including one, you know, done in montage format, it's a movie, you know, if you're going there to see, you know, a female butt kicker, as we've seen in some of these other movies, you're going to be sorely disappointed. You know, I know not everyone was the biggest fan of Jennifer Lawrence and Red Sparrow, but I actually kind of like that movie as kind of an interesting throwback that actually, you know, had a lot of, you know, was having a lot of fun with sort of an old school spy genre. And this one is just the same old shtick from Besson. And it only has, like, you know, really kind of like two big action sequences that are not terrible, I suppose, as Luc Besson movies go. Those two sequences are not that bad, but pretty much everything else in the movie is. I mean, the lead character is kind of a zero. We don't really get much about her. Sasha Lust doesn't bring anything to it other than, you know, a really pretty face that we see just kind of stoic and looking at the camera a lot. And the movie is just boring on top of all just being completely repetitive. And, you know, by the time you get to the end, you're just kind of like, okay, whatever. So you're just better off if you are a Luc Besson fan, just go back to the well, watch La Femme Nikita again, or heck, even watch Point of No Return, as far as I can tell. So you'll be much better off.
All right, Steve, what'd you think?
I liked it a little bit better than Eric. I will say this. I know for a fact Luc Besson finished shooting this movie before Red Sparrow ever came out. So he's not ripping off. It's just really bad timing. And let's just face it, that Atomic Blonde is basically a version of like 17 different Luc Besson movies. Done better, but it's still okay. So that aside, I think the things that kind of pulled me through this, and Eric is right, it is too long. The things that pulled me through it are, I actually thought Sasha Lewis was pretty good in this, considering I don't think she's ever really acted before. She's a model. I like that idea that she's playing a model because that gives her access to powerful men, and some of whom she's told to kill or, you know, otherwise infiltrate. And I think that's a funny idea, and I like the way that they don't treat it like a joke here. I also thought that Cillian Murphy, I can watch him in anything. He brings like a weird edge and a sort of an unexpected nature to most of who he plays, most of the characters that he plays in movies. And I think he's actually really funny in this, whether he means to be or not, doesn't matter. It's actually kind of great what he does here. Helen Mirren is really funny here. I like seeing her back using her accent, her Russian accent again. I think one or both of her parents are actually Russian. So that comes genuinely. I always imagine this was like the same character she played in White Knights, but maybe not. Believe me, no one is more surprised than I am that I actually enjoyed large parts of this movie. I even sent a message to our friend Peter Sadzinski, who will defend anything Luc Besson does.
Yeah.
And he didn't like this. And I said, I don't know, I'm going to have to check the tape, but I think I might have liked this more than you. And I couldn't believe it. But
yeah.
It's just like the last few things that Besson has done, I have genuinely just loathed. And And this was like just a nice, it was a, I kind of thought she did a great job in her action scenes. It looks like it's her doing it. You see her face for most of the action scenes. So I you know, that was nice, but it's true. It's nothing new, but Bassan kind of made this genre or subgenre. So anyway, I mild recommendation.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on a second, okay?
Yeah.
All right, Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We'll come back. We got more new movies to review here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Monday morning. My dad's going to call and tell a joke. And we're doing the movie reviews right now. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress. And let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Steve, tell us about Being Frank. I have not seen this, but I love Jim Gaffigan.
Well, you're going to get a lot of them this year. I think, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, this is the first of many movies that is actually being released. We've seen most of them.
Right. Yeah,
but this is the first one,
correct.
I think, at festivals, but I think this is the first one that's actually coming out. This is about a 17-year-old kid named Philip, who's played by Logan Miller, who's kind of desperate to leave his small town and his sort of narrow-minded family to go to music school at NYU. And when he proposes this to his father, who's played by Gaffigan, his father's like, no way. He just makes him even more of a rebel. So in retaliation, he sneaks off in search of sort of a wild spring break with his best friend, and he goes to the family's like a beach resort of some sort, or a lakefront resort, I guess it is, while his dad is on a business trip to Japan, where he goes a lot. And when he lands, he goes to this place, and it's like across the state line or something, and he finds out that his dad is actually there at the family cabin with another family, and another wife, played by Samantha Mathis, and two kids, and he has two kids with Logan Miller is the oldest of two kids, and now he has two more kids at this place. It turns out Frank has been living this life with two families for pretty much the entirety of either marriage. They got married, they kind of got involved with both women at the same time, and it sort of causes Philip to sort of reevaluate and figure out, well, do I blackmail my dad into getting what I want with this knowledge, or do I just throw a hand grenade in his life and tell mom? And he kind of realizes, even though he thinks he's in a position of power, he realizes that whatever he does is going to screw up his own life. And so what ends up happening is he lets his dad know that he knows, and weirdly enough, they become closer than ever. And it's strange because he doesn't want to hurt his mom. He doesn't want to hurt anybody, really, Philip. But and Gaffigan gives him a very honest story about how this happened and how he didn't mean for it to happen. It sounds like a setup for a comedy, but a lot of what happens in this movie is actually surprisingly serious and emotional, and it's had some really good performances here. I'm not saying it's a great film, but the way things by the end, it plays out a little too Three's Company, a little too sitcom-y, but because we kind of know where this is going, we don't know exactly where it's going to land, and that's also very interesting, I think, how it actually ends up. I wasn't as I'd heard not so good things about this, and I was sort of pleasantly surprised that it wasn't completely terrible. So I wouldn't say it's inspirational or anything like this, but it does tell a very interesting story, and it's a indie producer named Miranda Bailey who directed it. It's her first feature, and I think she does a pretty solid job with this. So again, mild recommendation. It's playing at the Landmark, so
yeah. And it was
if you do like Jim Gaffigan, yeah, you'd probably like him in this.
Yeah, well, it was originally called "You Can Choose Your Family,"
right?
That was the original title. So there you go. All right, but that's it. The Landmark, and it's out right now.
Yep.
All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about Child's Play?
Okay. Well, some of us remember a little doll named Chucky that's actually began in 1988 and had a number of theatrical sequels and even a couple of direct-to-video sequels. But now, you know, it's time for him to be given a new treatment, and he has been remade. Not with the soul of a serial killer, but this time actually is the victim, so to speak, of getting bad programming from the factory in Vietnam, of a disgruntled worker in the factory who is about to be fired, removes all of the safety gadgets off of the Chucky doll that is now basically... a buddy doll that is basically, you know, your standard Amazon Alexa tech type thing, a doll that is able to control everything in your house, from lights to television, and can also bring you your science book when you need it for school. So Aubrey Plaza plays a mother who works at a dismal Walmart looking outlet store, she has a young, or not so young, not as young as the original boy, budding teenager they've moved on to a new town. She's got a new job, and the boy doesn't have any friends, and she ends up taking the doll that was being returned, which probably not the greatest present in the world to take a doll being returned as defective and giving it to your son, but she does it. And the boy takes to the doll, soon the doll starts to elicit this behavior, learning things that you probably don't want the doll to learn, and eventually leads to murderous behavior on behalf of trying to keep his new best friend in the boy named Andy. I think with most horror remakes, a certain level of skepticism comes in. I, having watched the 1988 version recently by Tom Holland, I still think that movie holds up really remarkably well. It has a great sense of humor.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Eric, we had that at Flashback, as Steve, as you know.
That's right.
A couple of years ago, mm-hmm. I hadn't seen it in years. And,
yeah, it was last year, wasn't it?
Was it last year?
Yeah, it was last year.
Oh, okay,
year.
I'm getting my answer. Wow. Okay. But I had not seen it in years, and I watched it, at our outdoor screening, and mm-hmm. and you're right, it holds up really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, the movie, I mean, that whole series is, I don't want to say watered down, but, the number of sequels, the laws of diminishing returns on those films,
yeah.
But the Tom Holland film still holds up really beautifully, particularly Chris Sarandon's performance. I think it's hilarious in it.
Yeah.
But this one, I was actually quite surprised, how much I enjoyed it. I think this movie has a bit of that spirit of the original, that, it feels like a movie from that period that had kind of something interesting to say. Not that the original Child's Play, I don't think, really had anything interesting to say, per se, but this one, does. And we've seen a lot of movies, the dangers and horrors of technology, coming to life and all these kind of things. We've seen that done before, but I think that this movie takes some really interesting turns with that, particularly in one sequence where the doll realizes how much the kids are enjoying horror movies and what can be gotten a pleasure out of that. And I think that takes kind of a really interesting turn in the film. Mark Hamill does the voice of the buddy doll, who does get the name of Chucky. And I think he does tremendous voice work here. But then again, the movie has really fun with its gore scenes. I forgot to mention Brian Tyree Henry, who plays, more or less plays the Chris Sarandon role,
right,
as the cop who lives in the same building with his mother. He's really funny. in the film as well. And there's a lot of this stuff that I was smiling and laughing with. The couple of early kill scenes in the movie, I think, are really beautifully done. The finale, I think, has a wonderful manic, anarchist style to it. I think the movie has sort of one big flaw in the movie. I think it might be the casting of Aubrey Plaza in the role of the mom. I know that they kind of explain away that she was 16 when she has the kid, but it just feels like that character almost seems to be playing like the bad sister from the 1980s movies, and sometimes the bad mom from the 1980s movies with the boyfriend that she has around. And she just seems very disinterested in being there most of the time. Though I think the kid is pretty good. I could have used more Brian Tyree Henry. But I walked out of the film going like, that worked for me. So I was really pleasantly surprised how much I liked this movie. And I couldn't understand why United Artists Releasing or Orion decided not to screen it here in Chicago for critics. I don't know what they were thinking, because this is much better than most of the horror remakes we've been getting as of late.
Okay. All right. Eric, Steve, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. When we come back, Steve will tell us what he thought of Child's Play, and I'll tell you what I thought of Child's Play. And it's, we're right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. Monday morning movie reviews are happening right now with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. Before the break, Eric told us about Child's Play, the remake, and Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And he enjoyed it. Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Where do you stand on this, Steve?
I'm pretty much right there with Eric, actually. I will say, this film is aggressively, and we should make, not that you didn't make it clear, but this is aggressively not a remake, and I think that's the reason that I liked it so much. It's starting kind of from the ground up, and I like the updates. I like the idea that this is more about a movie about being scared of AI. For example, like being scared of self-driving cars, which factors into this movie quite a bit. And it has more in common with Hal than it does with the previous Child's Play movie. So, it's a really interesting take on this material. I like the way that a lot of Chucky's behavior is almost, I wouldn't say excusable, but it's understandable, because he's learning from a sort of corrupted position. And you're right, that scene where he's watching horror movies and watching the kids laugh and cheer at someone getting stabbed and mutilated. But then also things like, I love the idea that he is so protective of Andy and wants to be his best friend that he'll basically eliminate any competition for close friendship or anyone that wants to harm Andy, like this abusive boyfriend. It's a really great, I will say, the one play, it's almost a casual approach to the material, and the end is insane, almost to the point where I felt like they like, oh my gosh, we have to make this like a crazy Child's Play movie. We better throw in, and they just throw everything at us. And I also love that idea that there's a second wave of Buddy dolls coming out, and Chucky has corrupted them all as people are waiting to come into the store to buy them, and we're just waiting for this massacre to happen. And it's a great idea for an ending, but it's so sudden, because the rest of the movie has been a little more laid back about the way it approaches the horror, although it's very graphic and sometimes really disgusting, which is phenomenal. I'm all in favor of that. But but yeah, I mean, honestly, and I also want to talk about the look of the Chucky doll, because it's a little more detailed and cherubic, and there's more moving parts, and it makes it more lifelike, which only, you know, adds to the overall creepy nature of the thing. I will say, Mark Hamill's voice was a little too close to his Joker voice for me, but but beyond that, I was as surprised as anybody how much I enjoyed this.
Yeah, I can't believe I liked it. I mean, because I thought I had the lowest expectations for this thing, and it's very entertaining and it's really funny. Yeah, you're right. I mean, Mark Hamill is essentially doing the Joker here, which is fine because his Joker is great. I was on board for the whole thing, and I agree with you about the climax. It's insane. I thought that the work with the doll was great, and all the way around. And Brian Tyree Henry's really funny in it. I didn't have a problem with Aubrey Plaza. I thought she was fine. I'm a big fan of hers anyway, and she's a weirdo, and I like having a weirdo in this movie. So overall, I was like really, really surprised by it, and it didn't. And you're right, it's not a remake; it's a different take on it. And I do also really love the stuff about fear of technology and what's happening right now. With the Alexa and all that other stuff that people have in their homes.
I'm still trying to figure out why you would ever pair an Alexa with a child's toy, because it seems like that's going to be the first thing to break in your house.
Right.
Right. I'm not quite sure how those two go together. Like, you're ordering a car with your kid's toy seems wrong. But anyway.
Yeah. Well,
that would ruin the movie then.
Yeah, it would. But I was very surprised. I got to say, I was very, very pleasantly surprised by how enjoyable this movie is. And I recommend, fans of the Chucky series to definitely check it out. It's a nice addition to that series. So I still think the second one is the creepiest.
I like that one too.
I think the second one, I find the second one to be a really disturbing movie. And it reminded me a lot of I remember seeing it. I haven't seen it in a while, but I just remember seeing it it was a really sort of nightmarish kind of a children's fairy tale. The whole climax, which is in the factory, in the movie with with the conveyor belts and all that stuff, that reminded me of it was just so stylized and weird. It reminded me of the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, in that style. And I think it was inspired by that kind of stuff. And I haven't gone back and watched the second one, but I remember being very disturbed by it.
Mm.
So, all right. Well, let's see then. Steve, why don't you tell us about Toy Story 4?
Yes. I'll admit I'm genuinely surprised there are people on this planet that were labeling this film before they saw it as some sort of weird cash grab or unnecessary thing. And as much as I agree that Toy Story 4 did sort of end with a wonderful air of finality and closure, the only way to really make this a fourth one work is if you just try something really different. And I think if there's any filmmakers in any studio, and I'm talking about Pixar, not Disney, if there's any studio you just have faith in when they decide to make a movie like a Toy Story movie, that they're going to do it and they're going to have something interesting and new to say, it's definitely this studio. So the real treat here is that there are a host of new themes and ideas at play in this film. There's a maturity here that I wasn't expecting. And above all else, it's the funniest Toy Story movie that's ever been made. And there's so much going on, and there's so many themes and messages here, and hopefully we'll get to a couple of them. But these bigger ideas, there's bigger ideas at play here, namely this idea that you don't have to accept the label that's put on you. There's a new character in this film named Forky that I said to you, Nick, is the crackhead of the Toy Story universe. He thinks of himself as trash because basically that's what he would have been. He's a spork with googly eyes and some pipe cleaners for arms, and he's just barely a toy. But Bonnie, who owns all of the toys in the Toy Story universe, made him and seems to like him the best, and then he comes to life because of that. But just because he was put on this earth perhaps to be trash doesn't mean you have to accept a label that's put upon you. And it's an incredible message that's put forth in this, and it's a very grown-up message. And what I love is that as we get older and these films, I mean, this is what, more than something like 25 years plus on these movies, they have grown up with the original audience. Like, we were much younger people when that first one came out, and I feel like this movie in particular has grown and matured as we have. So, you know, Tom Hanks and Tim Allen are still both around as Woody and Buzz, and Woody in particular has sort of been sidelined by Bonnie, but he's still very protective of her feelings. And when Forky gets ejected from the car that they're in on a road trip with her family, he goes after him, and in a lot of ways this film feels like several different script ideas put together. There's like a carnival thing where we meet all these new characters. There's there's a bunch of stuff in an RV where her family is an antique store that is sort of the scary part of the movie, but it's not nearly as scary as three was. We should talk about some of the new characters. Key and Peele have been reunited here. These stuffed animal prizes at a carnival, they're attached together by a string, and they are hilarious, and they are very dark, and they have a very dark vision of what a toy should be. We have Christina Hendricks as a baby doll in the antique store, who we think seems like a nice person until we meet her army of scary ventriloquist doll bodyguards or whatever they are. And it turns out she wants to, in a way, dismantle Woody for his voice box. But again, the more we find out about her, the more we realize she has, like, her intentions are better than her actions maybe allow us. Like I mentioned, Forky before, who's voiced by the great Tony Hale. He's just a remarkable character that seems like he's just going to be nuts the whole time, but even when he sort of stabilizes, he becomes really interesting. And then, of course, another contender for fan favorite is going to be Keanu Reeves' character as a sort of a Canadian Evel Knievel knockoff named Duke Kaboom, who seems much more into posing on his motorcycle than actually performing death-defying stunts. I will say this about Reeves in this film. He reminds us of two things. One, that he has an incredible sense of comic timing, and he's in on the joke about what his image is. And I think that really makes a huge difference in this movie, and I'm ready for the spin-off movie with his character whenever they want to do it.
Steve, hang on a second, okay?
Yeah,
hang on a second, because we got to take a break here, and then we'll come back. We'll talk more about Toy Story 4. We'll get Eric's view on it. Steve will finish up, and I'll tell you what I thought of it, too, right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Monday. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about mafia and mob movies and talk a little bit about Batman, the Tim Burton version with Michael Keaton, which celebrated its 30th anniversary over the weekend, and we'll tell you a little bit about that. Right now, Eric Childress, Steve Procopi are with me as every week we review the new movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hi there.
Okay, Steve, you can finish up your review of Toy Story 4.
So what I was going to say, I was just going to end it by saying that the film definitely has the intent of making you laugh more than cry, but of course, this is a Toy Story movie, so we know you're not going to get out of this without a few tears, and it's there. But man, I mean, just... It really does make you. It doesn't tap into that nostalgia for our childhood this time. This is about something much bigger. Like I said, it's about escaping labels that are placed on you. But it's also like there's just so many really beautiful messages here. It's more than about the action adventure, but that's there, and it's more about the laughs, but it's there too. And I just, you know, this is like 4-star for me. This is definitely, I think, one of the best Toy Story movies, maybe my second favorite. And I don't feel like they need to make another one, but if they do, I'm not going to second guess them if they got a great idea. So
yeah.
Highly recommended.
All right. Eric.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just listening to Steve's description of the Forky character and what that character represents, I almost found myself tearing up right now, just because I think that it is such a beautiful idea and creation for a movie that is most decidedly not even in the same universe as a cash grab. You know, people need to remember that, you know, when the original Toy Story came out in 1995, we had really never seen animation quite like this before. It was literally the beginning of a new revolution. It was really the coming out of Pixar. And, but it's also, you know, and now this one actually kind of feels like a throwback to the period when animation or animated films were events, there was a reason that so many animated films were good back in the day, because they had to take their time. They had to, they didn't have all the technology available to them where, they were hand drawing everything, or they had limited technology where it would take, 3-4 years to put something like this together. So they had that time to work on the script and the characters and everything and the songs and everything would just come together in this beautiful whole. It's almost unfair to rank these movies against one another. Everyone is out there trying to say, well, this one's not as good as the other three, or three disappointed me and this one brought it back. It's as unfair, I think, as ranking Richard Linklater's Before movies against one another. They're all part of this incredible whole, and this movie in some way, this series in some ways is almost like the animated version of the Before series, because not only, as Steve said, that the audience has grown up with these characters, but these characters itself are existing in that same timeline. This movie begins in 2010 when Toy Story 3 came out, and flash forwards to the present time, or at least a couple years afterwards. I can't remember the exact timeline, but the point being is that they waited. We thought Toy Story 3 was the end. It almost literally was at one point, and they took their time and they found a way to deal with the same themes that they've dealt with before in the past, but come up with some very new ones. And while I was watching the movie and laughing my head off so much at Duke Kaboom, and not even realizing at first that Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key were those two characters until I started to hear them talk. I'm like, oh, that is just genius casting right there, and provides one of the biggest laughs of the year during the end credits of the movie. The way that this movie was progressing, and having heard some of the way that Tom Hanks had described the emotional ending of this film, I was actually preparing myself for actually a much darker ending, the way that I thought that they were going to transfix what was happening between Forky, Woody and everything. I was really worried it was going to go down a much darker path, and then it got to a point where I didn't know if I was going to lose it, and then I did at a key moment. And this is a movie that I'm going to be thinking about a lot. I can't wait to watch it again, and for other people to see it. And I think that over time, people are going to stop ranking these films and just start enjoying them as a gift that Pixar has given the movie universe.
Yeah, the Toy Story movies are one of the greatest franchises in movie history. There's no question about it. And all four of these movies are great. And I don't want to rank them in any particular way, but I have to say this. I don't know if I've laughed harder at a Toy Story movie than this one. I laughed my ass off. And there is a scene. The Key and Peele characters that they play, Bunny and Ducky. And those characters, the addition of those characters, and Duke, the Duke Kaboom character, these are really beautiful and rich and really funny characters that add to this universe. And a lot of the older characters kind of get sidelined in this movie, because it's mostly Woody's adventure, and Buzz Lightyear shows up a little bit, but all the rest of them, all the other like Trixie and Dolly and all the and the and you know the uh, Mr. Potato Head and all those, they're kind of in the sideline in the background a little bit, which is fine. But that makes way for these new characters to show up. There is a sequence in the movie where I was crying with laughter, like my sides were killing me, and it's a scene where the Key and Peele characters are explaining what their plan is.
Yep.
To get a key from an old woman in this antique store. I don't know if I've laughed harder at anything this year. Like, that whole sequence. And then, of course, there's a big payoff at the end with that. But it's great stuff. It's wonderful. It's you know, you love these. I love these characters, man. I really do. And I love how they handle it. I think the new characters, again, are really, really great. The Gabby character. The ventriloquist dummies are hilarious. And Forky is an amazing, you know, an amazing new character. And really, you know, that's what the core of the movie is saying is beautiful. And then just on the simplest of levels, it's just unbelievably entertaining. And like I said, I don't know if I've laughed harder. I've not laughed harder at a Toy Story movie than this one. It is unbelievable.
We should mention, because none of us have mentioned this Bo Peep character, the Annie Potts comes back.
Yeah.
And she's kind of critical to everything that happens in this movie.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than she teaches Woody that, and us, that there are some toys out there that don't care about being hooked up with just one kid.
Yeah,
they want to be there for all kids.
Oh, I think Eric, hold on, something's going on with Eric, but go ahead.
But yeah, I mean, there are some toys in certain places that want to be hooked up with all kids, and that moved me almost more than anything.
Yeah.
That there were like people like, of course, like, why wouldn't they want that?
Yeah.
So, just another beautiful piece of this thing.
Yeah, it's great stuff, man. I mean, it really is. And
yeah.
All four of the Toy Story movies are great. And so there you go. Now, I know that Eric's not going to be with us next week, Steve. So we're going to we're going to handle all the new stuff.
Okay.
So we've got, I'm really looking forward to Yesterday. That's that's Danny Boyle's new movie. About a world without anybody knowing who the Beatles are, and then
with
we have
one person knowing,
just one person, and then we also have another Annabelle movie,
which I've seen.
Okay.
Oh yeah,
all right, okay, Steve, I'm going to get back with Eric. We're going to do the box office, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, thanks. All right,
take care, buddy. Right. There you go. There, Eric, you back?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about the box office.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Toy Story 4, $118 million. How is that compared to the other money wise?
Well, it's the highest grossing opening of the entire series, although you'll find that a lot of the people writing about box office this week, there was actually much higher expectations for this movie, and I think it's important for people to realize the term expectations when it comes to what was happening here, because we talk about these tracking services all the time.
Yeah.
Toy Story 4 had, like, tremendous... Like, for one day presale, like, it was beating Finding Dory and Beauty and the Beast and stuff, so those stories came out. So everyone, was anticipating, like, this could break an Incredibles 2 record last year, which opened to $182 million,
right.
People forgot.
Right.
So people were expecting something along those lines, and when it doesn't deliver those numbers, everyone starts going, like, oh, well, maybe they weren't interested in seeing another Toy Story movie, and then you have to remind them, no. People, it made $118 million in 3 days.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's a really solid opening. It's only disappointing when you measure it up against the inflated expectations.
Yeah.
That people had for it.
Yeah. Well, I loved it. I don't care.
Yeah, and people are going to love it.
Yeah, yeah. The audience, both my parents loved it.
Yeah.
We laughed hysterically during the entire movie, and everybody in the theater. And the theater was packed, and everybody in the theater had a great time. So,
yeah.
Number two, Child's Play, $14 million. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, for a horror remake, it's behind sort of other horror remakes, like Last House on the Left. Did a little bit better than Child's Play did. I think that there were some better, bigger expectations for this. Some people were thinking that this could pull in 20. I was thinking more around 16 to 18, and the estimates kind of came down lower even throughout the weekend. So it is $14 million. It's not particularly great, but it's not a very heavily budgeted film either.
Right.
So the film will probably end up on the plus side. It's just the number is not going to look very sexy.
Got it. Number three, man, oh man, this thing. Aladdin, $12.2 million. I can't believe. $287 million total. I had no idea it was going to make this kind of money.
I didn't think so. I didn't think so either, man. I thought that this, you know, after the Dumbo kind of tank, and I didn't, you know, the way that people had responded to the early, you know, the images of Will Smith and Blueface,
yeah,
I didn't think there was going to be that much interest in this movie, but apparently people like it. You don't make this much money without people recommending it to their friends.
Yeah.
And other families, and now it's over $810 million worldwide.
Man.
This is about to become Will Smith's biggest grossing film ever. It's about to pass Independence Day.
That is nuts, man.
Yeah,
that is nuts. Speaking of Will Smith, Men in Black International made $10 million, $52 million total.
Yeah, dropped very significantly as expected. It's only up to about $52 million, so it's definitely not going to get to $100 million. It's up about $185 million worldwide. The last Men in Black movie made over $600 million worldwide. Men
wow.
in Black 3. So this movie, you know, if it makes half that, it'll be lucky.
Yeah. The Secret Life of Pets 2 with $10 million. It's up to $117 million. That's not doing as well as the first one, right?
No, this movie, I'm kind of happy because it's not very good, and maybe people are kind of on to Illumination's game at this point. But I mean, this movie looks like it's probably likely going to come in $200 million less than the last movie did, and that's just domestic.
Wow,
because the Secret Life of Pets made over $875 million worldwide, and this movie hasn't even cracked 200 yet.
Wow.
So even internationally, I mean, it's Illumination is only about an $80 million budget, pretty cheap for an animated film. So it probably will squeak by with a profit. But you know, this is a message to them that they can't just churn out the same old stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Number six, Rocketman, $5.6 million, up to $77 million total. That's about where everybody thought it would be, right?
Yeah, doing very well, and actually has kind of an outside shot at making $100 million at this
mm-hmm.
point.
Yeah. Number seven, John Wick Chapter 3, $4.4 million. It's $156 million total. It's made about $55 million more than Godzilla. Now, who would have who would have thought that?
Not me. I mean, I had it doing fairly well. I think I had it just doing right around $100 million at the beginning of the summer, but I had Godzilla doing about 170.
Yeah.
So it wasn't me. But you know, hey, good for Keanu. He's having a good summer.
Oh, you're not kidding, man. Keanu's having a good time right now.
Yeah, and I say bring on Bill and Ted 3. That's
yeah,
all I got to say.
Absolutely, man. And number eight, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, $3.7 million, $102 million total. That's not good.
No, it's just under $350 million worldwide. It's got to crack at least $425 million to break even. So the Godzilla versus Kong, that might be the last to see of this.
Oh man, number nine, Dark Phoenix. Oof, $60 million total. Ugh.
And it's doing better than Men in Black, though.
Oh yeah. And then Shaft pulling up the end here at number 10 with $3.5 million, $15.9 million total. Not good.
No, not good at all. And we'll see if how those estimates hold, because Anna actually finished in 11th place with like about $20,000 less than Shaft made. So we'll see if those estimates actually swap tomorrow. But
yeah.
You know, like $3.3 million for Luc Besson's movie. That's not going to even crack $10 million.
Right. Okay. All right. And then next week, what do you think? Annabelle number one?
No, Toy Story.
Toy Story will stay number one. Yeah.
Yeah, Toy Story will stay number one. The new ones, yeah, Annabelle, I think will be a very healthy number two. And I'm curious to see how Yesterday performs. I think that's a movie that could have a bit of a kind of adult word of mouth,
curiosity to it. It seems like, I mean, just judging by the trailer and everything and the concept of it, it seems like it's got a niche audience, but it also seems like it's going to be a crowd pleaser. It just feels like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, don't expect big numbers for it. I mean, I would think I'd probably put it somewhere around like 11, 12 million maybe next week,
right.
I think, and then we'll see how word of mouth grows from there.
Right.
But the Toy Story will be a very healthy number one next week.
Okay, cool. All right, Eric, you're off next week, right?
Yeah, I'm going to take off next week, so I'll leave it to you guys. But I'll be back with Spider-Man and Midsommar.
There you go. Okay. And by the way, your birthday's coming up. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
We're exactly 1 week apart. Your birthday and then my birthday is exactly a week after yours.
That's right.
Well, there's an actual 10 years difference. But all right, Eric, thanks, man.
Thank you, man.
Take care. He's going to take the week off, and happy birthday to Eric. We're going to take a quick break here on 720 WGN.